Welcome back to the PFRPA podcast. I'm your host, Brian DeMarco, and today I have with me Steve Doolittle. Steve, how are you, man?
Hey, great to be with you guys. This is just absolutely awesome. I'm looking forward to this nice little conversation, and thank you for inviting me.
No, I really appreciate you hanging out with us today. So first, let's give everybody some backstory. Tell me about where you grew up, where you went off to play college ball, how you got into the pros. Tell me some backstory.
Yeah, I grew up in Tucson, Arizona, and we went out there from Kansas City when I was born, and my father had the asthma situation. So I grew up in Tucson. We won state championship in 1975 in Arizona, and we were 12-1. And that was my junior year. My senior year, I transferred into being a wishbone quarterback, believe it or not. Well, our quarterback went on to become University of Arizona starter, Jim Cron, and he played with the Eagles for a little while and the Philadelphia Stars. But what happened was we didn't have a quarterback. So we lost our first game to our sister school, which was a double-A school up on the hill. And it was really, truly an embarrassment. You just don't lose to your sister school that's a double-A
right?
on top of the hill. So anyway, so the first-year coach, we had just won state championships. So we got the first-year coach, and he came in from some real small town like Morenci, Arizona. And he looks at me, and he goes, "What can we do?" I go, your guess is as good as mine. You know, I'm 17 years old. And he says, "Well, can you play quarterback?" And I go, I guess I'm going to have to. We're down to
What are you going to do? Tell him no? Did he expect a no? You know, well, no, remember, coach, I'm no good.
Yeah. We just won 12. We just were 12-1, and then this guy, our coach, takes off and goes up to Mesa, Arizona, and he takes a job up there. So now all of a sudden, how do you fill a position after you go 12-1? You can only lose. You can't.
Right.
You know, the new guy coming in, you can't. You know, you're just going to lose. You can't possibly win because you're just 12-1. So, the first guy comes in and he loses the first game. So naturally, you go, this is going to be downhill. So, he says, "Well, can you play quarterback?" I go, "Well, I guess I'm going to have to because being an athlete, I was." And I said, "That's fine because I played four sports anyway," and. So
back in the good old days when we actually played other sports
and played both ways.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Exactly. You never came off the field. But anyway, so I took the helm and we went 9-1. So we didn't lose again until we got to the state finals and we lost to a big overwhelming school that had like 3,500 students. And we had like 1,200 or 1,300 and we lost 10-0. And so that was 9-2, but I felt that was okay. So what happened was I was recruited by Frank Cush. You guys may be old enough to remember Frank Cush.
Sure.
He's the coach of Arizona State. And I was being recruited by Terry Donahue at UCLA. And I ended up finally going to the University of Colorado. Bill Mallory was the coach there at the time. And he was a disciple of Woody Hayes and Bo Schembechler.
Yep.
They were all from Miami of Ohio. And the reason why I went to Colorado was because when we went on our recruiting trip, we didn't stay in hotels, and where all the other trips we took, you stayed in hotels and they dined and wined and dined you and fancied you out. So we actually stayed in the dorm, and Bill said, basically, he goes, "Listen, let me tell you something, Doolittle. You know, if you're going to come to play football here, we're not going to be staying in no hotels. So he goes, you're going to stay in the football dorm." And so I went back, home after that experience, and I told my mom, and I had lost my father when I was 10 years old. My brother was in Vietnam. So I kind of grew up with just my mom. And I felt kind of bad about thinking about going away from high school, from home in Tucson. And I said to her, I said, "Listen, I have a chance to go to the University of Colorado. They just went to the Orange Bowl against Ohio State and, you know, a lot of top players." And she said, "Why don't you just go away and become a man?" And I said, "Well, wow. It really hit me pretty hard because I'd seen her on her hands and knees cleaning sororities at the University of Arizona. And I just said, "Well, you know what? I got a scholarship, got an opportunity." So I went to the University of Colorado and played there. So I got into Colorado as, believe it or not, a wide receiver, like a U-back or tight end, whatever it was at the time. And I ended up playing a little bit as a freshman, got a letter then. And then I went to my sophomore year. And Bill said to me, he says, listen, you're not going to be running. You're not going to be running with these deer that we got on the team. You're going to, he goes, the chances of you playing wide receiver are slim and none. I'm going, okay. And I was like 6'2", 6'3" at the time, maybe 200 pounds, 212 pounds. And he says, well, you know what? Why don't you go play on the other side of the ball? And I'm going, what does that mean? You know, because I right. I know you played defensive back in high school as a quarterback, but you don't want to get hurt. So, so I said, okay. So I went over there, and I ended up starting as an outside linebacker my junior and senior year, and at 78 and 79, and then everybody left from that team after 79. And I ended up being the only starter on the front seven returning
my
senior year. So, but we got Chuck Fairbanks as a head coach at that time. Do you remember Chuck Fairbanks?
I do.
Okay. Well, Chuck came and, you know, he came from the professional football ranks, of course, from the Patriots. And so he comes into the University of Colorado and he wants the fancy office. He wants all this stuff redone, remodeled. He wants everything done. And all of a sudden, the University of Colorado, now keep in mind, University of Colorado in the 70s was probably like the Berkeley of the 60s.
Well, so, yeah, sure.
So it wasn't really beneficial for you to be dressed in sweats when you go to class.
Right?
You know what I mean? You're not going to be
looking. You're going to pick you out real fast.
Oh, boy. And so anyway, so Chuck ended up spending so much money in the athletic department that 11 minor sports had to be cut.
Are you kidding me?
No, it was really bad. I mean, it was all the way down to men's wrestling. They cut it, all the women's sports. I mean, it was just absolutely crazy.
Boy, could you imagine with Title IX and all that today?
Oh,
trust
me. So I became captain my senior year. And so I went up to everybody on the team and I said, listen, you get up in the morning and you take a shower and you put on a regular shirt and regular pants and go to class. Do not wear your sweats that say Colorado football. You're going to get D's. You're going to be failed.
Right. You know? So I actually have a story about that. I got to tell you real quick. So I went to Michigan State.
Yeah.
This is the early 90s. And I remember, you know, you're so proud. You get on campus as a freshman. You get all your Michigan State gear, right? And so I go to class the first day wearing my Michigan State football sweatshirt. And I'm all excited. And I walk into my English class, and, you know, you're a big man on campus, first day of college, and the professor calls me out and says, hey, are you on the football team? And, of course, I kind of gloated and said, oh, of course, yeah, I am. She goes, great, haven't passed one yet.
Yeah.
So like, you know, oh, man, I'm in trouble.
Yeah, you can feel that boat that you were in at that point sinking, didn't you?
Yeah, for sure. Oh,
yeah.
My gosh.
So anyway, to finish the story of my college career, Chuck came up to me at my senior year and he said, listen, you know, you're not going to be drafted very high if you play outside on that outside line. You're just not going to, they're just not going to take you. And you know, you're telling a guy, you know, you put your whole life on the line about playing professional football since you were a little kid in your Green Bay Packers suit with Bart Starr. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so Chuck goes, listen, you're going to have to move inside. I go, what does that mean? He goes, you're going to have to become an inside linebacker. He goes, you haven't played it. I go, no. He goes, you're going to have to play inside linebacker. And I'm going, okay. He goes, I said, well, I guess I'm going to have to do it because same thing I did in high school when I played quarterback. So in order for it to play, I had to go inside. So the first game, we fly out to UCLA. It was hotter than hell that day, September 1st or right after Labor Day, I think it was. And we're playing in the Coliseum when UCLA was still in the Coliseum along with SC. And Freeman McNeil is a running back. Kenny Easley is a DBs. We got Louis Sharp as a tackle. We got Tom Ramsey, Jay Schrader as quarterbacks, right?
Wow.
Remember, the front seven guys in front of me don't have one quarter's of playing time experience. Okay?
Oh,
so we go out there, we play, and all of a sudden it's 52-0 at halftime.
Oh, wow.
We are just getting killed. So we go
just
in the
to say, I'm taking it not in your favor.
No, absolutely not. Freeman was having a great day. So we go into locker room And, you know, all our daubers are down. We're just sitting there and we're just, it's hotter than hell and sweating. And, you know, remember, we're Colorado guys up at 6,000 feet. We're down here. It was really hot and smoggy at the Coliseum. So yeah. Chuck used to smoke cigarettes a lot. And he used to kind of look at you with one eye kind of closed. Like, think of Clint Eastwood in the old spaghetti westerns, right?
Yeah.
And so he goes, boys, let me tell you something. Anybody ever been down 52-0 at halftime before? Exactly. I mean, he said it just like that, but he said, and he had the cigarette up by his mouth. He goes, well, I sure haven't been, for damn sure. He goes, okay, the chances are we're not going to win this damn game, but get out there and make it respectable.
Oh my gosh.
And that's the kind of guy Chuck Fairbanks was. So we went out, and I still played the entire third quarter. I think I had 18 tackles that game, but, wow. But after the third quarter, the defensive coordinator goes, you're getting killed. You get the hell out of there. Right. But you know what? We lost 52-14. So we scored 14 points and didn't let him score anything.
It saved the day, man.
Yeah. But that, right? but that was my first experience of trying to learn. So we ended up my senior year, we ended up going 1-10. And the only win we had was against Iowa State. And Iowa State came to play at Colorado, and they had a running back named Dwayne Crutchfield. I don't know if you remember him or not.
No, I don't.
Yeah, and he was a big runner, and he had 22 straight games of over 100 yards. And he talked, you know, you had the locker room paper material all week where they post the stuff on the boards and say, and he talked about dancing in our end zone and this whole thing. So, they were ranked number 3 in the country at the time, and we were obviously in the cellar. And so they came to play, and we ended up winning 13-9. We held him to 62 yards, and I was named defensive 8 player of the week. I had like 14 tackles, nice. An interception, and about three quarterback sacks. So that was it for me. And then we ended up losing the rest of the year, and Oklahoma had the highest scoring game against us at one time, 82-42. Wow. So you say, hey, they scored 82 points against you? Yeah. Wow. And then you say, well, how many times has anybody scored 42 against Oklahoma?
Oh my gosh.
It was a real track meet. They scored every which way. They had J.C. Watts. They had David Overstreet. They had
How long did that last, that record, 82-42?
Yeah, it was up until 90. That was 1980. So I think 98.
Yeah, somebody scored 100 points or something like that.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, those guys were laying on the sidelines over across on the sidelines, and they had their shoulder pads off. They were so disrespectful, and they had the oranges. They were lying with oranges, and they thought they were going to the Orange Bowl, the whole thing. So, well, the only good news is that that was it for me at the time. And then Chuck had kind of campaigned for me and ended up being selected to 3 All-Star games on a 1-10 team, being an inside linebacker. I was
not too shabby.
I was named all league, and then honorable mention all American. And then I ended up going to the Blue Gray All-Star game, the Hula Bowl, and the Senior Bowl, where that year we had some pretty good guys that year. Howie Long, Lawrence Taylor, Mike Singletary, Ricky Jackson, Freeman McNeil, Ronnie Lott. You know, the list goes on
wow,
and on.
What we had a class.
Yeah,
wow.
We had a.
Was that the 1980 draft class?
No, 1981 draft class. So we had Eric Wright. We had, like I said, we had Everson Walls. The names go on and on and on. We had Andre Franklin, George Rogers, the Heisman Trophy winner, Mark Herman.
It's literally an all-time class.
Yeah, that's we had a pretty good that class probably lasted quite a long time as far as many guys got drafted and they stuck. And I got drafted by the Buffalo Bills in the 7th round. They spread a little thing about me. I think my coach got on me about a hamstring issue. And once you get labeled with a hamstring issue, it's kind of bad. So I hung out till the very end. I got drafted there, and they ended up removing me, and I went to San Diego Chargers for a short period of time after, and I had back surgery. And I had back surgery, I came back into camp, and I was playing really well, and then I got the call I'm the general manager, and says, well, you know, you're going to have to, you know, you're on your way out of here because, you know, you have the back surgery and we just can't.
Right. Yeah. So especially back in those days.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's bad news now, but yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, they just didn't have the money as they had back then. You know, Dan Fouts was our number one player at the time. And I think he was making $600,000 a year. Think about what Dan would make today, you know, something like that.
Oh, boy.
But, yeah. But that was it for us. A minimum wage was $35,000, I think.
Wow. And, so one of the things I like to hear from the guys is, you know, we all have this moment when we first get into the league, like it's that moment where you realize I've made it. I'm here in the NFL now. What was that moment for you?
I think going against in Buffalo when I was obviously second team, you know, and I don't know if you guys remember Jim Haslett.
I remember Jim Haslett.
Jim Haslett was the starting linebacker with Shane Nelson and Lewis Sanford in Buffalo at the time. And we had Freddie Smirlus was our nose tackle and Ben Williams. And anyway, so what happened was Jim held out. And I was supposedly the replacement. And I was doing really well at the beginning of camp and everything. And it was 6 weeks of two-a-days. And it seemed like it rained every day. And it seemed like my shoes never got dry. Yeah. We were up in Fredonia, New York. I mean, it was, you know, and then it's just one of those things where you go, and I didn't miss it, you know, having the injury label, I didn't miss a day of camp. 6 weeks or two days. I did not miss a day of camp, you know. And I think
at least you were up north, though, where it was cooler. I got drafted by Jacksonville. So,
oh, yeah. Yeah.
Playing in the swamp that is Florida.
Yeah, I could see how that would be very tough. Yeah.
Oh, man.
So I think when I really arrived is when I got into camp and I had to go against Reggie McKenzie and Conrad Dobler.
I know Conrad.
That's when I knew I arrived, is when I took those guys on every single day in camp. And I used to look up to those guys. You know, Reggie McKenzie blocked for O.J. Simpson, and Conrad Dobler was in the league with the Cardinals. And he was one of those badass guys. And those, you know, and I just started hitting them. And I said, you know what? I actually won some battles. And I said, this is that rite of passage that you were just asking me about.
Yeah,
and I think that's when it was. And Isaiah Robertson was on my side, and Phil Villapiano. So they took me underneath their wing. And that was when I kind of felt.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, especially when they asked me out to go drink beer with them, and I was the designated driver.
Right.
Yeah, back in the day.
They invited you in, so that's how you know, hey, you're here now, right?
Exactly. Even though they were stepping on me like a doormat, I knew that I had arrived.
That's right.
So that's what I remember. Yeah, that's what I remember.
Fraternity, for sure.
Yeah.
Oh man, that's crazy. I love hearing those stories because it's, you know, it's the things that the camera never captures, you know, so
no.
We have these unique stories that nobody else would ever know.
No.
You know, unless we get a chance to share it on a platform like this, right? So it's really cool to hear. So let's go to the next step. So the transition portion of getting back into the real world. That is a hot topic today. Everybody wants to be a transition coach, and there's a lot of programs out there for guys now. You know, there wasn't anything like that when we were done. Tell me about your transition. Was it an easy transition for you? You know, I'll tell you, for me, it took me at least 5 years to kind of get back into, okay, I need to find purpose in my life and get beyond football. What was your transition like for you?
Yeah, I could see why, Brian, it does happen that way for many of the guys. You know, all I ever wanted to do was play professional football. And after I got done playing in the USFL with Memphis, Reggie White was a rookie my last year. And
very cool.
Yeah, he was the first millionaire that I saw because We didn't have
the USFL came out of the box paying some of those guys. I remember that.
Yeah, they paid Steve Young. Yeah, they paid Steve Young a lot of money, and they played like because you're designated a certain location back then to territory. I ended up going to the New Jersey Generals first, and so that's where I was with Herschel Walker and who they paid the player, Brian Sipe. And Gary Barbaro and Jim LeClaire and some of those other guys like that. But then I got
Brian
traded.
Brian Sipe, that was a hero of mine growing up.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, he was really, really good. Yeah, right. He was really, really good. And so then what happened was I ended up getting traded to Memphis. And so I ended up playing in Memphis with Walter Lewis. He was a quarterback from Alabama. Rod Schoate used to play with the Patriots. And a lot of ex-guys that played. So Reggie was the rookie that year, and he was the first millionaire. And I remember him getting his brand new Trans Am, red as red could be. He got a brand new Trans Am.
Nice.
I go, hey, that's pretty good, kid. Good for you. He was really a sweet guy, and I played outside linebacker, and he played defensive end next to me. So he was a pleasure too. Anyway, so I ended up my last game. It was against Tampa Bay in Tampa. And Nate Newton, do you remember him that played for the Cowboys?
I do.
He kind of rolled on my knee.
Yeah.
All 325 pounds rolled on my knee, and that was about it for me.
So that was it, huh?
Yeah. So I left, and I came back to California, and I was really, 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 really good friends with Howie Long. And Howie introduced me to his commercial agent. Making commercials on television.
Sure.
And so I said, okay, I'll go with you one time. And he said, fine. And so I decided, the guy says, hey, you know, what are you doing? I go, really? I'm transitioning, just like the question you asked me. And exactly, because I didn't think about whether I was going to go back and play ball or not. Or, you know, once you get the back surgery and the knee, and, you know, and they're not paying a lot of money, and you got to, even though you want to play, it's just at this point you become 26 years old and you go, you know, how much more can I give? You know, what can you do?
Yeah,
and sure. So I decided to go, and the guy goes, well, let's go make some headshots. And I said, oh, what does that mean? I didn't even know what that meant at the time. And so I went and got headshots, and he goes, okay, but so I said, well, what do I do? He goes, well, you just go home and wait for me to call you for appointments. I go, what does that mean too? He goes, well, you get auditions. And I go, what does that mean? And so he ended up laying down the breadcrumbs of how it goes. And I got my real quick, class on it. And I ended up going out for some commercials. And then I said, I went for a Miller beer commercial. And all it was an all day filming session. It was in Silver Lake, and it was like in a barn. And do you remember when Danny Sullivan was the IndyCar driver, and he had the Miller beer car?
No, that might be before my time.
Yeah, okay. It was when Larry Bird and Magic Johnson always had the playoffs going all the time.
Yeah,
when those
I remember
guys
that.
Were, okay. Well, Miller decided to do a campaign, and it was called Miller's Made the American Way. And so I went on this commercial shoot, and I had no idea what it was. And the guy goes, what are you here for? I said, I'm here for the football audition. He goes, you don't look like a football player. I'm going, what? I just got done playing. He goes, no, you look more like a bartender. I go, okay. He goes, can you come back tomorrow dressed as a bartender? I go, sure. I don't even know what a bartender dresses like, right? So I come back with a white shirt. I roll up the sleeves, turn my watch around, you know, kind of have my shirt undone a little bit. And next thing you know, he goes, okay, now go over there and just do this and kind of like clean up around the bar. And the place is packed with all kinds of extras and stuff like that. And all it was just interaction with people. And so it went out the whole day. And then I asked my agent, he goes, well, you know, you're going to get paid for the day. I said, well, how much do you get paid for the day? He goes, well, it's scale plus 10% for your agent. I said, well, okay, what is that? He goes, well, it's like $330, and you get $30 for me. I said, oh, okay, whatever that is.
Yeah.
He goes, but what time did you quit? I go, it was midnight. He goes, oh, well, you went into gold time. I go, I have no idea what that means. So I ended up going into gold time, and I think I ended up making $800 and something dollars for the day. And I go, this is awesome. And so he goes, well, you won't know. I go, am I going to be on the commercial or what? He goes, well, you just never know on the editing and how long they're going to take. So anyway, all of a sudden you don't ever find out anything. And a lot of times, you know, you're just on the cutting room floor. And so I finally called my agent and he goes, did you know that they interviewed 1,000 people for different pieces? I go, I had no idea. He goes, good luck with you. You know, good luck with that and everything. So all of a sudden during those football game, the basketball games that were going on with Magic Johnson and Larry Bird, all of a sudden I see this commercial and there I am. And I'm on for maybe 2 seconds. And all of a sudden for a year, I go to my mailbox every 2 weeks and there's like $1,200. There's $1,200. There's $1,200. Nice. I made $26,000 on that one commercial for 2 seconds and I didn't say a word. I said to myself, I'm transitioned out, baby. This is the way you go. Yep. I never need to work again. I never need to put a tie on. This is just absolute awesome.
And it's easy, right?
So, boy. And it was fun because it was a great way to pick up girls, the whole thing. You know, it was awesome.
Right. So you got the acting bug. So where'd you go from there?
Yeah. And so then after that, I started going for theatrical acting. And then I got on a soap opera for about 9 months. And it was called Rituals back in the day. And it was on Metro Media. And I was obviously the toy or the quarterback of the football team on the show. And my name was Rowdy Barrington. And Tina Louise was my girlfriend. Do you remember Tina Louise?
No, I don't.
Yeah, you do. Ginger or Gilligan? Ginger on Gilligan's Island.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah. So she owned the team and I was her plaything. So at that point, yeah. So I ended up being on that show for about 9 months and then we went off on a bus trip somewhere and we never came back. So that's how you get fired.
And wow.
Yeah. And then
not
I ended
a bad
up,
gig though.
Yeah. And that was good too. Cause there's, you know, regular work and I transitioning out, just like you said. Almost every nighttime drama. I co-starred on almost every nighttime drama at the time, like Crazy Like a Fox, Trapper John, Highway to Heaven, these types of shows. Yeah. These types of shows and a couple of movies of the week. And then what happens is you end up, not getting called anymore. And then you end up either getting older or you're upstaging the star and they don't want that to happen. I was on Mike Hammer. I was on Mike Hammer and Stacy Keach, you know, you're just bigger than these people. And if you don't stand in this is the time back in the 80s. And it was just kind of the time. And then all of a sudden it just dries up and you go on 1,000 interviews and you don't get a job. So now you have to deal with rejection. And so at that point I said, that's enough for me. And then I got into video production and stuff like that. And I started a video duplication business out here with a partner. And we got into producing instructional videos and stuff like that. And at that time, that's what it was. And then we ended up selling the business. And I just went into a consulting situation, which is what I'm doing now with marketing. So that's really the transition for me. And it wasn't as hard. But I think being in Los Angeles, you really have to do it. Otherwise, this town will eat you up quickly.
Well, look, it wasn't a bad transition. You're hanging out with Ginger from Gilligan's Island.
That's true.
That away, man. You should be the prototype for transitioning.
No, hey, you know, I wish I could write a book on it and tell you how I did it. It's just kind of like one of those things where one step in front of the other.
No, that is crazy interesting. And so... So what? Tell me about what you're doing now. Are you still just consulting now? I know you have a business with the neuroscience.
Yeah. Well, I was consulting for a lot of self-taught websites, how I do things, and I use marketing and stuff like that. I got into that better because it's just one of those things where I could actually, after you have 35 employees, and you had to get up every morning to make X amount of dollars to pay those employees. And after 12 years, you go, you know what, I'm just getting kind of tired of it. And I can go into something a little bit better for myself and that I can control. And then I could put all the money on me, you know, for my experience. And I know that I'm going to get up every morning and be there as opposed to whether some employees are going to show up or not. And you're going to make your money or something's going to dry up, especially with technology back in the day, because VHS went into CD-ROMs and then CD-ROMs went into DVDs. And now everything's in digital. And every time you make a transition on a technology issue, you had to have a lot of capital to invest in order to make the transition, or otherwise you get eaten up. And at that point, I just made a decision. I'm thinking, you know, this is, technology is moving much faster than I can move at that point. And I said, okay, that's enough for me. So I just went into consulting and marketing and stuff like that with websites and emails now and all different type of social media stuff. And so a little while ago, I was approached by these ex-Navy guys, and they asked me to come on board. And I've known one of them for 35 years, and he was a special weapons diver on nuclear sub. And now I'm the chief marketing officer for this company, and it's a wonderful opportunity. I think it's something cutting edge, and I think it's I'm now ahead of the curve as opposed to having to catch up. And I think that's sure. where we are.
So, what's the name of the company?
The name of the company is Artanium Executive Group, and it's spelled A-R-E-T-A-I-T-A-N-I-U-M, Artanium Executive Group. Okay. And what we are really is a corporate wellness company, and which tries to, it's based in neuroscience. And what we do is we found out from my partner that he had been consulting for large companies like Hewlett-Packard, Symantec, and all these other companies in the Silicon Valley, and on team building and leadership qualities. And he's an accomplished author, and he wrote a book on the 7 secrets of neuron leadership. And what we found out is that people don't understand that their bodies and their minds are out of balance. And a lot of times you get disengaged. And there was a poll from Gallup that says 80% of employees are disengaged on some level or another in their current work position. So that means you're losing money. That means companies are losing money and digital transitions and stuff like that. So what happened was he invented a test, a personality profile test. And he's telling you that based on your personality, you may be in the wrong position at the right company. In other words, Brian, you may be playing quarterback, but you're in the wrong position. You should be playing right tackle, or you should be playing, you know, something like that. Right. And what we do is we take your test. It's about a 7 to 8 minute test online. And then what we do is we determine your personality, and it's based off the Greek Enneagram, and it's whether you're an introvert or an extrovert. And then what happens is we determine there's 18 different ones. And then depending on how you come out, we have our own proprietary supplements that go for that particular personality to get you in balance, to get your oxytocin levels and your serotonin levels in balance. And the only way I can explain it to you without really digging deep into the PhD part of it is that let's say you like broccoli. Let's say you just think broccoli is the greatest thing in the world and you got to eat broccoli every day. Well, guess what? That broccoli may be bad for you, and it may be keeping you out of balance, which keeps you disengaged. You should be eating asparagus, and you just don't know it. So what we do is we are the solution for you to tell you that you should be eating asparagus. And that's really the layman's way I can explain it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it's just like everything else in life, right? There has to be a balance. And obviously the nutrition aspect and how you perform physically, whether it's on a football field or in business, is huge. It's just huge to make sure that balance is taking place and that you're treating yourself appropriately. So that's very interesting. I'll have to definitely dive in a little bit more.
Yeah, we're the only one that's neuroscience based. And I went to, believe it or not, I went to a seminar at the Natural West Expo in Anaheim this past year. And I went to one of the speaking sessions by Dr. Dale Bredesen, and he's from UCLA, and he's a pioneer, and he's a trailblazer on Alzheimer's. And what he did is he got up in front of everybody in the seminar, and he introduced his granddaughter. And he said, let me introduce you to the first generation that will not have to worry about Alzheimer's. And I was just taken by that. And I actually listened to the whole hour and a half speech. And at the end of the speech, he basically said, it's all about supplements. In other words, one size does not fit all. In other words, you can't go back to that, you know, one a day vitamins. You have to do the supplements that are geared towards your brain and the way you're made up. And so I called his office a couple days afterwards, and I told his assistant what we were doing, and she goes, "You guys keep staying the course because you're probably onto something." He goes, and she said, and I said, "Well, maybe we can maybe perhaps work together on some level. There may be some kind of connection that we could work with together and design a certain thing." So we have our neuroscientist PhD specialist that makes sure our formulas are correct and everything.
Right. No, that's fantastic. Well, Steve, thanks for hanging out with me, man. I appreciate it. This has been a great ride hanging out with you today and learning about your playing days and your transition and your memories. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me. I mean, it's, you know, you get to be 60 years old and all of a sudden you go, what did I remember? Did I remember correctly?
Right.
Because, you know, sometimes the stories are bigger than they really were.
That's right, man. Don't we get a little bit better with age, at least in our own minds, right?
Exactly. We kind of remember the things the way we want to remember them as opposed to the way they really happen. But I think on this case, I think we did pretty well. And anyway, I appreciate being with you guys. And I invite you to take the test. Go on to gateway86.com. It's a free test online. Be my guest. And what it'll do, it'll spit you out about a 25-page report on your personality and what kind of tendencies that you do. And then it'll tell you. Yeah, so it's kind of really interesting. We're doing that right now.
You heard it here, folks. Go to gateway86.com and take your free test.
Yeah,
check it out.
Yeah, sure.
I'll be definitely checking it out as well.
No problem.
All right, Steve, I appreciate it, brother.
Guys, have a great day. Thanks again. Thanks again.
Talk soon.
Everybody be well.
Yep.